Chapter 16. Zelimir Kovach enjoyed killing. He hadn't discovered this particular interest until civil war erupted in his native Yugoslavia and he had been drafted into the military. Prior to going into the army, Kovach had been a construction worker and amateur heavyweight boxer. But it was in the military that he found his true vocation. For 5 glorious years, he and his unit of like-minded men had torn a swath through the country, killing Croats, Bosnians, and Kosovars by the hundreds. By the time of NATO's intervention in 1999, Kovach, who had been born with a different name, heard rumblings about trials for people who had committed crimes against humanity. He was certain he would head the list of those sought by the authorities, so he deserted, fleeing first to Bulgaria, eventually to Greece. Standing at 6'8", with the build of a wrestler, it hadn't taken him long to find a niche in the Athens underworld as an enforcer. His street cunning and ruthlessness were rewarded with promotions within the organized crime world, and he cemented his reputation by killing an entire gang of Albanian drug dealers trying to horn in on the heroin trade. During his first few years in Athens, he began reading books in English to learn the language. The material itself was unimportant to him, and he read biographies of people he'd never heard of, histories of places he had no interest in, and novels whose plots he didn't care about. The fact that the books were in English was all that was important. That is, until he found a dog-eared book in a second-hand shop. The title intrigued him. We Are Breeding Ourselves to Death, by Dr. Lydell Cooper. He mistakenly thought it was a book about sex and bought it. Between the covers was a rational explanation for everything he had believed since the war. There were too many people on the planet, and unless something was done about it, our world was doomed. Of course, Dr. Cooper didn't single out any ethnic groups in his treatise, but Kovach read the book with his own racist perspective and was certain Cooper meant the inferior races, like the ones Kovach had slaughtered for so long. With no natural predators, there are no limits to our burgeoning population, and the hardwiring in our DNA to procreate means we will not stop ourselves. Only the lowly virus stands in our way, and each day we draw closer to eradicating this threat as well. He took this to mean that mankind needed predators to cull the weak so that the healthy could thrive. This wasn't Cooper's point at all. He wasn't espousing violence of any kind, but that didn't matter to Kovach. He had found a cause he could truly believe in. Man needed predators again, and Kovach wanted to be part of that. When he discovered that the responsivist movement had opened a facility outside of Corinth, he knew finding that book was providential. Thomas Severance himself was at the compound the day Kovach had shown up to offer his services, and the two men talked for hours, discussing fine points of Dr. Cooper's work and the organization it had spawned. Severance subtly made Kovach understand the true philosophy behind responsivism, but never once tried to blunt the Serb's rough edges. "We ourselves aren't violent, Zelimir," Severance had told him, "but there are others who don't understand us, who want to ensure that our great founder's message isn't spread. No one has tried to hurt us yet, physically, I mean, but I know it's coming. Because people don't want to be told they are part of the problem. They are going to lash out at us, and we will need you to protect us. That will be your function." So Zelimir Kovach would continue his role as an enforcer, only this time he did it for the responsivists and himself rather than for drug lords and dictators. Gil Martel looked sleek behind his desk, his bronze hair slicked back and his capped and bleached teeth shining when Kovach strode in. Martel could only hold the pose for a second before his smile faded. Hooking up with Tom Severance had been good for him. It got him out of L.A. before the police closed in on his auto theft business again. He had a huge house facing the ocean just down the road from the compound, and any number of willing women for his bed from the transient population of responsivists who came to Greece on retreat. Part of him even believed that there were too damn many people on the planet. He didn't believe any of that garbage about alien membranes, but he was a consummate salesman and could feign belief better than the most devout. As for Tom and Heidi's master plan, what did he care about a bunch of rich people on cruise ships? It was only around Kovacs that his facade cracked. The big Serb was a psychopath, plain and simple. Gil didn't know the man's background, but could only assume he'd been involved in the ethnic cleansing he'd read about in Yugoslavia back in the late 90s. The rescue of Kyle Hanley had been a disaster, but Martel felt he could handle the fallout. He didn't need Kovacs watching over his shoulder and reporting every little detail back to Tom and Heidi. He admitted he should have anticipated his office had been bugged, but he'd said nothing substantive before turning on the jamming device. It was a minor lapse that didn't warrant Tom calling in his creepy lapdog. Kovacs held a finger to his fleshy lips in a shushing gesture before Martel could speak. When Kovacs reached the desk, he shut off the jammer, then took a small piece of electronics from the inside pocket of his black leather jacket. He systematically swept the room, his small eyes never leaving the electronic readout as he moved the device over bookshelves, furniture, and the carpet. Satisfied, he slipped it back into his pocket. So there weren't any. The weight of Kovacs' stare pressed Gil Martel farther into his chair. Kovacs upended the desk lamp and peeled the tiny eavesdropper from the base. He wasn't familiar with the particular brand, but he recognized its sophistication. Because the bug was so small, he knew that somewhere within a mile or so of the compound, a booster transceiver retransmitted whatever the bug heard to a circling satellite. Searching for it would be futile. End transmission, he said into the microphone, doing his best to mask his accent. He then crushed the bug between his thick fingernails, grinding it until it was as fine as particles of sand. He finally looked to Martel. Now you may speak. Was that the only one? Kovacs didn't bother answering such an inane question. I will need to sweep everywhere the intruders penetrated. It would be tedious but necessary. Have the guards draw up a map of the possibly infected areas.
Of course.
But I can tell you that they only entered my office and the dorm. Feeling his head throb at Martel's utter stupidity, Kovacs had to physically calm himself. When he spoke, his English was heavily accented, but clear. They had to breach the perimeter wall and cross the compound to this building, and then make their way to the dormitory. They could have dropped bugs along the paths, thrown them into bushes, stuck them to trees, and even left some on top of the walls.
Oh, I didn't understand.
Kovacs gave him a look that said, "You are right. You don't understand." Was there anything on your computer pertaining to the upcoming mission?
No, absolutely not. All that stuff is in my safe. It's the first thing I checked after getting off the phone with Tom.
Give me that material, Kovacs ordered. Martel considered defying the Serb and calling Severance, but he knew that Tom trusted Kovacs on all matters concerning security and that his protests would fall on deaf ears. The less he had to do with their scheme, the better. In fact, maybe it was time to move on from here. The break-in might be a sign telling him to cash in while he could. He'd skimmed almost $1 million from the Greek retreat. It wasn't enough to live on for the rest of his life, but it would certainly establish him well enough until he found something else. He got up from behind his desk and strode across to his office sitting area. Kovacs did nothing to help him move the furniture off the oriental rug or fold it back to reveal a trap door and, below, a mid-sized safe embedded in the floor. The chairs and tables were in their exact position when I came in, so I know nothing was moved, he explained as he worked. And look, the wax seal over the keyhole is intact.
Kovach didn't bother telling Martell that a professional team, like the one who'd entered the retreat, would know to replace the furniture in its correct position, and while a wax seal was a good touch, it could be duplicated if they'd had enough time. But he wasn't all that worried that the safe had been their objective. He'd glanced at the file they had on Kyle Hanley, and he suspected the young Californian's family had hired a hostage rescue team to return their son. No doubt they would have hired a deprogrammer as well. Most likely, Adam Jenner. The very thought of the man's name balled Kovach's hands into fists. "Here we go," Martell said, and pulled the strong box out of the safe. There was an electronic keypad on its lid. The facility's director tapped a numerical sequence and smirked at Kovach. According to the box's memory, it hasn't been opened in 4 days, which is when I got the latest updates from Tom. A child could have reprogrammed the strong box with a UBS cord and a laptop, but again, Kovach held his tongue. "Open it." Martell entered his passcode numbers. The box beeped and the lid lifted slightly. Inside was a 3-inch-thick manila folder. Kovach stretched out his hand for Martell to hand him the file. He glanced through the pages quickly. It was lists of names, ships, ports of call, schedules, as well as short biographies of crew members. Completely innocuous to anyone who didn't know their significance. The dates mentioned weren't too far in the future. "Close the safe," Kovach said absently as he thumbed the file. Martell complied, settling the lockbox back into its niche and securing the door. "I'll put on the wax seal later." Kovach glared. "Or I'll do it now." Martell's tone was flippant. He kept the wax in his desk, and the seal was the prep school ring he wore but had never earned. A few minutes later, the Killam rug was back down and the couch, chairs, and coffee table in their places. "Did Kyle Hanley know anything about this?" Kovach held up the file like a zealot proffering a holy book.
"No. I explained it to Tom. Hanley had only been here a short time. He'd seen the machines, but knew nothing of the plan."
Martell's casual response triggered a look of suspicion on Kovach's face. The room seemed to chill a few degrees. Gil made his decision. As soon as Kovach left, he'd head to his house, pack up a few things, and hop the next plane to Zurich, where he kept his numbered account. "It's possible he might have heard rumors," he amended.
"What sort of rumors, Martell?"
Gil didn't like how Kovach said his surname and swallowed.
A few of the kids here are talking about a sea retreat, like those that went on the Golden Dawn. They make it sound like a big party."
For the first time, Kovach's cool veneer seemed to slip.
"Do you have any idea what happened to that ship?"
"No. I don't let anyone here watch the news or use the internet. I haven't either."
"Why?
Did something go wrong?"
Kovach recalled Mr. Severance's words when he'd phoned from California this morning.
"Do what you think is right."
Now he understood what the responsivist leader had meant.
"Mr. Severance doesn't trust you much."
"How dare you?"
"He put me in charge of this retreat and the training of our people," Martell blustered. "He trusts me as much as he does you."
"No, Mr. Martell, that is not the case. You see, 2 days ago I was on the Golden Dawn and participated in an experiment. It was glorious. Everyone on that vessel died in ways I haven't imagined in my worst nightmares."
"The what?" Martell shouted, sickened by the news and the reverent way Kovach said it, as though he were talking about a favorite piece of art or the peacefulness of a sleeping child.
"They are dead. All of them. And the ship scuttled. I had to secure the bridge before releasing the virus, so nobody could report what was happening. It swept through the ship like wildfire. It couldn't have taken more than an hour. Young and old, it didn't matter. Their bodies couldn't fight it.
Kiel Martell backed around his desk as if it could act as a barrier to the horror he was hearing. He reached for the phone.
I have to call Tom. This can't be right.
By all means, call him. Martell's hand hovered over the handset. He knew that if he made the call, Tom would verify everything the twisted thug had said. Two things flashed through his mind. The first was that he was in far over his head, and the second was that Kovach wasn't going to let him out of his office alive.
"Just what did Mr. Severance tell you about the operation?" Kovach asked.
"Keep him talking," Martell thought frantically. There was a button under his desk that buzzed his secretary in the outer office. Surely Kovach wouldn't attempt anything with witnesses.
He told me that our team of researchers in the Philippines had engineered a virus that causes severe inflammation of the reproductive ducts in both men and women. He told me that 3 out of every 10 people exposed who were infected will become sterile and will never be able to add to the Earth's population, even if they tried in vitro techniques. The plan is to release it on a bunch of cruise ships where everyone is basically trapped, so they all become infected.
That's only part of the story, Kovach said.
So what is the truth? Where is that damned woman?
Everything you said about the effects of the virus is true, only there is something you don't know.
Kovach gave a triumphant smile.
You see, the virus is highly contagious for about 4 months after infecting a host, even though it shows no symptoms. And from a handful of cruise ships, it will spread around the globe, infecting millions upon millions until every man, woman, and child on the planet has been exposed. That 3 out of 10 sterility number is closer to 5 in 10 unable to breed once the infection has run its course. This isn't about preventing a few thousand passengers and crew from having children. It's about stopping half the world.
Gil collapsed into his chair. His mouth worked to form words, but no sound came out. The past 3 minutes had been too much. The Golden Dawn. He knew 100 of the people on that ship, probably 200. Now this. This monster telling him that he'd been working for 2 years on a plan to intentionally sterilize 3 billion people. He wasn't going to lose any sleep over the sterilization of a couple thousand cruise ship passengers. They'd be depressed, but life would go on, and, as a bonus, he bet a few orphanages would be emptied. He should have seen it was going to go far beyond that. What was it Dr. Cooper had written in We're Breeding Ourselves to Death? Arguably, the greatest transfer of wealth in human history occurred when the plague swept Europe and wiped out 1/3 of its population. Lands were consolidated, allowing for a greater standard of living, not only for the owners, but for those who worked for them. This event single-handedly paved the way for the Renaissance and gave rise to European domination of the world.
We have taken Dr. Cooper's words and turned them into action, Kovach said, giving voice to the horror echoing in the empty chasm that had once been Martell's soul.
Martell thought he was safe behind his desk for the moment, but he hadn't counted on the big man's strength. As if the desk were no more than a cardboard box, Kovach shoved it into Gil, pinning him in his seat against the back wall. He opened his mouth to shout out to his secretary. Kovach wasn't especially quick, and the responsivist director managed a hoarse croak before his throat was closed with a jab to his Adam's apple. His eyes bulged from their sockets as he fought for a breath he could not draw. Kovach looked around the office. There was nothing he could see that would make this look like a suicide until he spied the pictures hanging on the wall. He scanned the faces quickly and knew which ones he would use. Leaving Martell struggling to fill his lungs, Kovach crossed to a photograph of Donna Skye. The actress was too skinny for his tastes, but it wasn't much of a stretch to believe Martell would be in love with her. He snatched the picture off the wall and carefully slid the glossy from the frame. He smashed the glass on the edge of the desk. Kovach pressed Martell into his seat with one massive hand, while with the other he selected the largest glass shard, a dagger at least 5 inches long. He released Martell's head and grabbed one of his arms, making sure to keep his grip loose enough so he didn't bruise the tanned skin. The glass cut into his flesh with spongy resistance, and dark blood welled up from the wound, pooling on the desk before drizzling to the floor. Gil Martell struggled, thrashing in his seat, but he was no match for the Serb. He could only manage a rough cawing sound that wouldn't be heard beyond the office walls. His movements became slower and more uncoordinated as his strength ebbed through the gash until he finally went limp. Careful not to leave bloody footprints, Kovach slid the desk back to its proper position. He hefted Martell's body from his seat and reversed the chair so he could set the corpse astride it. He lowered Gil's head until the bruise on his throat was hard up against the chair's wooden seat back. The coroner would attribute the bruising to his head tipping forward when he passed out from blood loss. The final detail was to arrange the photograph of Donna Skye so it seemed to be the last thing Gil Martell saw before his death. As Kovach closed the office door behind him, Martell's secretary entered the building through the main door. She was carrying a ceramic coffee cup and a large purse. She was in her late 50s with a bad dye job and an extra 50 pounds hanging from her frame.
"Well, hello there, Mr. Kovach," she said brightly.
He didn't recall her name, so he said, "Mr. Martell is at his desk already. As you can guess, he's very upset about what happened last night."
"Terrible thing."
"Yes, it was," Kovach agreed with a somber nod. He felt his cell phone vibrate in his pocket. He asked that he not be disturbed for any reason today.
"Are you going to find out who attacked us and get that poor boy back into the fold?"
"That's why Mr. Severance called me down here."
Patricia, he thought. Her name was Patricia Ogdenburg.
He checked the screen on his phone. It was Tom Severance, requesting a secure phone call. Considering they had spoken earlier that morning, something critical must have happened. Kovach repocketed the cell. Patricia looked him in the eye, tilting her head back to do so.
"Pardon me for being blunt, but you must know that a lot of folks here are intimidated by you."
When he didn't reply, she plowed on.
"I think you are as tough as you look, but I also think you are a very caring and thoughtful person, too. You understand social responsibility, and I find your presence a comfort. There are so many ignorant people out there that don't understand all the good we do. I'm glad that you're here to protect us. Bless you, Zelimir Kovach."
She laughed.
"You're blushing. I think I embarrassed you."
"You are very kind," Kovach said, imagining the loneliness that had driven her, like him, to responsivism.
"Well, if a compliment can make you blush, then I know I'm right."
"Oh, how wrong you are," Kovach thought as he left the building without a backward glance.